You're listening to Opening Ceremony Keynote Presentation, What Works on Wall Street, by James O'Shaughnessy of O'Shaughnessy Asset Management.
James O'Shaughnessy is the Chairman, CEO, and Chief Investment Officer of O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. He, in effect, is ultimately responsible for the investment strategies of the firm. And he develops all the management existing strategies and directs the team that generates ideas and specific initiatives to improve the models that develop factors and are in use for their money under management. In fact, he was featured in the journal, the October journal, so I think it's in your packet if you haven't read it already at home or downloaded it online, but there's an article that he co-authored here, and it talks about some of the strategies that he's changed with. I've been an active reader of his works for many years. When I was editor of Computerized Investing, I remember working off Invest Like the Best, which actually used, I think it was a value screen product to go through and analyze the characteristics of a successful mutual fund so you could go ahead and apply your own screens. But he's a well-received author. He's written Invest With Like the Best, How to Retire Rich, and Predicting the Market of Tomorrow. And then most probably best known for his classic What Works on Wall Street, which was revised recently. I believe we're on the fourth edition of the book. And I've carefully read the first and second and third, and I'm looking forward to reading the fourth. And in it, he presents a very interesting analytical perspective on the marketplace. He goes back, looks at factors that have worked, that have been helpful in predicting different strategies in stock that are turned out to be successful. And I think it's a very interesting way to analyze things and to find investment winners. He's been long recognized as one of America's leading financial experts and a pioneer in quantitative equity analysis. In fact, he's been called a world beater and a statistical guru by Barron's. And I understand that Forbes just recently named him a one of seven legendary investors. So he's up there with Marty Zweig and Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham and Peter Lynch as well. And fortunately, he's alive with us, so it's too many legends are not available to give us their expertise. So I'm very excited to be able to introduce James O'Shaughnessy. And one more bit of information here. Would you please welcome a AAI Life member, James O'Shaughnessy.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Delighted to be here. Obviously, unfortunately, Warren Buffett was unable to make it. So I got the call, and I'm like, oh, got to fly down to Florida. Oh, all right, Warren, I'll do that for you. Before we go into our presentation, I like to tell a story which illustrates, I think, the difficulty we all face as investors in trying to make determinations on what we should invest in and when we should invest in it. And it concerns this fellow who dies and goes up to heaven, and he sees this big group of people, and he's no different than anyone else, so he wanders over to the big group of people, and he sees sitting at the center of the group is Albert Einstein. And Albert Einstein is saying, hi, Albert Einstein, welcome to heaven. What's your IQ? And the first guy he points to, he goes, I really don't want to brag, but, you know, I was pretty smart when I was on Earth. I was a scientist, and I was working in quantum mechanics, and my IQ is 195. And Einstein goes, oh, my God, I haven't had one of you up here for ages. Afterwards, you've got to wait, and we have to talk about unified field theory, quantum strangeness, all of the things that I would really, really love to get caught up on, but, you know, here I am in heaven with infinite knowledge. I already know about them, but it sure would be great to have somebody to talk to about it. And he goes, sure, I'd be happy to. Then he points to the other guy, and he says, hi, Albert Einstein, welcome to heaven. What's your IQ? He goes, well, it's not 195, I can tell you that. He goes, unfortunately, when I was on Earth, I was pretty normal. You know, I had a good job, and I had a lovely wife and kids, but, you know, I really didn't excel at those kinds of things. He said, my IQ was 115. And Einstein goes, that's fine. We'll talk about politics and everything that the politicians are doing. And then he points to the third fellow, and he said, "Welcome to heaven, Albert Einstein. What's your IQ?" And the guy looks at him, and he goes, "I'm not going to tell you." And he goes, come on, you're in heaven. Soon you're going to have infinite knowledge. Everything in the universe will be known to you. It doesn't matter what your human brain could comprehend things at. Now that you're up here, you are all-knowing and will be all-seeing. You'll have all the information of the universe at your fingertips. Come on, what was your IQ when you were on Earth? Guy sighs, kind of shakes his head, and he goes, "Well, put it this way. I made Forrest Gump look like a genius. My IQ was 55. And Einstein goes, "What do you think the Dow's going to do tomorrow?" I think we all sometimes feel that way when we're trying to make decisions about what to do and what to pay attention to in the marketplace. About 12 years ago, I got the idea that what I would like to do is quantitatively take a look at every single factor that investors fancy. So you always heard somebody say, you got to buy low PE stocks. You got to buy stocks with the highest earnings gains. You've got to buy stocks with the highest dividend yield. And what I thought was, why? I mean, is there any long-term proof that any of this stuff works at all? Because you've got to remember, back during this time period, the folks who said that the stock market was efficient and could not be beaten were in the ascendancy, right? They were the ones who were responsible for virtually all the introduction of new index funds. John Bogle comes to mind. And my idea was, well, let's see. And so I went looking for the research. Being a very lazy man, I thought, well, I'll be able to find it elsewhere. And what I found was very interesting. I found a speech given by Ben Graham, the founder of Modern Securities Analysis, in 1946, in which he said, "It is a reproach to our industry that we have no long-term data determining whether the things that we are doing are efficacious or not." And he said, until we have long, long periods of data to actually empirically improve what we are doing, we cannot dare call ourselves a profession. We are an art. We are not a profession. And so I dug deeper, and I found a lot of academic research. And I would read it, and I was like, oh, this is incredible. This is exactly what I was looking for. This is, okay, fabulous. And then I would read the footnotes. As a caveat here, folks, the truth loves the footnotes, okay? So always read them. So I got to the footnotes, and it says, for the period 1980 through 1985. For the period 1980 through 1985, 5 years. Anything can happen in 5 years. If you are at the end of 1999 and are looking at 5 years, what are you going to invest all of your money in? Internet stocks, technology stocks. If you are at the end of 5 years and 1973, 74, and have the courage after that bear market of going into the marketplace, where are you going to put all your money? In value stocks. What we need, Richard Brealey specializes in this, and he basically says, you need at least 20 years of data to see whether there is a formula or a strategy that's going to be efficacious over long periods of time. So I got a big kick out of the 5 years, and I thought, well, this is meaningless. You know, at my old firm, we used to keep a portfolio of stocks whose ticker symbols were comprised only of vowels, A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y. And in 1996, the vowel portfolio beat the S&P 500 by 10%. Can you imagine going out and seeing a client and saying, we have a real secret for you. Only invest in tickers that are vowels. Look, last year, up 10% over the S&P 500. Obviously, anything can work in any given year. And so one of the messages that we try to get people to really understand and really take to heart is that the short term is meaningless. It is absolutely meaningless. And as a matter of fact, it is misleading. If you are looking simply at short-term results, I can virtually guarantee you, you will fail as an investor. And it's human nature to want to do that. It's human nature to want to turn on CNBC and see what the stock of the day is. It's human nature to want to see what Cramer has to say about a particular stock. It's human nature because you know what? In all the time that I'd been on CNBC, I started in the late 90s, it morphed from really a serious show about money into ESPN. I mean, basically, we have 10 heads going and, you know, all the scores going that way. And I was watching ESPN one day, and then I clicked over to CNBC, and I go, they're no different. They're identical. So what we want to do is try to focus in on the facts. And the challenge that we have faced there in the beginning was it was very difficult to find a database that was comprehensive enough so that we could get the amount of data that we needed in a timely fashion. And I'll tell a funny story here. I convinced the people at Standard & Poor's CompuStat to give me access to their entire database. They'd never done that for an outsider before. And it was my simply persistent nature that got them to do that. And so literally they ported the data from their mainframes to a computer that I had to have specially made in Stamford, Connecticut in 1995. And so I walked into the computer store and I say, yeah, I'd like a 486 machine with two CD-ROM drives and all the rest. And the guy behind the counter just looks at me, just blank. He was like, dude, are you going to do a nuclear power plant? And I went, no, I'm going to do stock market research. And he was like, oh, well, all right. Anyway, we ported it all over and we did the first edition of What Works on Wall Street. And it was a pretty simple and straightforward book. What I was trying to do was identify which factors did the best. And in my naivete at the time, I didn't realize that there might be something called a horse race as to which factor is going to be winning, depending on what time frame you look at. So for the entire period of the book, annually since 1950 and then monthly since 1963, we determined that price-to-sales ratio was the king of all value factors. I've learned to regret that term because it's not true. And we found out it's not true through further iterations of our book. Price-to-sales, great returns in terms of the marketplace. You do about 3.3% better over all the extended time period in the time of the study, 1950, through at this time, which was 1993. And so we found that there was consistent outperformance. And you'll see at the bottom there, there's a thing called base rates. Base rates, we believe, are the most important statistic you can look at in determining the efficacy of a strategy or a factor. The higher the base rates, the better. What these mean is pretty simple. It means that in any given 10-year period, about 90-plus percent of the time, just buying the stocks with the lowest price-to-sales ratio beat the market as a whole. Very, very nice batting average, very, very consistent. Those are the hallmarks of what you're looking for when you're trying to determine a group of factors or a single factor that is going to be reliable. We don't want to use factors where there is a great deal of inconsistency on the rolling 3 or rolling 5 year period. So one of the things that we found, though, when we went and dug into the data was that three sectors were really overrepresented when you use the lowest price-to-sales ratio. Consumer staples, consumer discretionary, and telecom. The other sectors were very rarely invested in the portfolio. Now, obviously, one of the things that we all know as investors is unless we are sector experts, we don't want to concentrate into just a handful of sectors. It can be great when that sector is on fire, but when that sector loses steam and starts a nosedive down towards earth, it can be really, really painful. So one of the things that we wanted to do was We wondered, what about combining factors? I had actually read an academic journal in which the authors had said, cited my work in What Works on Wall Street, and they said, but if you add in P-E ratio, you end up getting a much better return. In fact, 4.6% as opposed to the 3.3% that we were seeing from price to sales alone. And then I did a different thing. I started running various factors alone, but with different start and stop dates. What I wanted to see was, does the time frame that we're looking at influence what we're going to find? And that's exactly what I found. So, for example, if we stop in 1986, price to earnings does better than price to sales. If we stop in 1999, EBITDA to enterprise value does better than PE or price to sales. This led us to the conclusion that, well, why don't we use them all? One of the primary benefits to this, and this is our value composite, in which we use all of the various factors that we have found have the highest degree of efficacy in terms of being used just on their own. And what we found was that by using them in concert, we were able to achieve results which were significantly better than any value factor on its own. For example, in 2007, Ford Motor Company had the lowest price-to-sales ratio in the S&P 500. And yet, when we ran it through our value composite, it got a horrible score of something like 70. The higher the score, the worse the score. So if your score is 100, watch out below. You have no value. You are incredibly overvalued. Conversely, if you've got a score of 1, you are the best value in the bunch. And so by using this composited methodology, we were able to significantly refine our definition of what a value stock was. And you'll be happy to hear that our research team at OSAM is working with AAII's research team to come up with proxies for these various composites. We have data differences. We use CompuStat, WorldScope, MSCI. We use a host of different data sources. So we are diligently working so that you are going to be able to make use of proxies of these on your software. The nicest thing about the value composite was its return. If you had simply bought, starting in 1963, the decile of stocks with the lowest or the best score, rather, on the value composite, you were earning well in excess of 17% as opposed to 11.1% in the cheapest decile. That's all you did. Once a year, buy those stocks, you ended up 17%+ doing nothing more than that. Now, what kind of names are we looking at? Well, right now, DirecTV, Seagate Technologies, Travelers, Macy's. And I always love it when we get to the name portion because it's almost as if a portion of our brain snaps shut. There's got to be a lot of people who say, I hate DirecTV. You know, I have DirecTV, and they're always coming out to fix it, and they always look like ex-cons. And you know, I say to my wife, DirecTV's coming, I better wait around. I want to make sure. And she goes, I've already hidden the jewelry. They can't go upstairs, you know. And they come, and indeed, it looks like they just got out of Folsom Prison, right? And so people like that have had that kind of experience with DirecTV. They've had the experience where they're watching their favorite sports team, and, you know, mine happens to be Notre Dame, no booze, playing its rival at the University of Michigan. And just as their Notre Dame is in the red zone and they're going in, because it started raining. So DirecTV has a lot going against it. In addition to the ex-cons and the fact that they cut out during thunderstorms. But as a stock, it's a great example of a great stock is not always a great company. And conversely, a great company is not always a great stock. The reason DirecTV is on this list is it is dirt cheap. It has great financial strength. It has really good earnings quality, and which we're going to get to in a minute. And so it is a stock that belongs on the list and should be bought if your goal is to buy the cheapest names. Other names, Travelers, you might have had a bad experience with Travelers. Most people have bad experiences with insurance companies. Seagate, I was on Fast Money. The greatest irony, right? I sat down on Fast Money where I don't know how many have seen the show on CNBC. Basically, it's a shout fest, right? I like this, and I bought these options, and you know. And so when I sat down, I said, well, this is slow money, so this ought to be interesting. But we were talking about Seagate, and they were like, well, it's a commodity company. I mean, why would anyone ever want to own it? And we said, well, you'd want to own it because they're returning like 18% a year to their shareholders through dividend and buybacks. And that's been one of the most powerful final things that we've been able to find. And it's interesting because it got to the crux of the matter. Most people think in terms of a stock's name. They do not think in terms of the stock's underlying characteristics. So think about it this way. Let's say the insurance industry, life insurance industry, decided that they were going to look at you the way the typical investor looks at a stock. They come out and meet you. Jim, how are you? Good to meet you. Boy, you seem like a nice guy. Everything. Yeah, we're going to give you the insurance. We see you have high blood pressure, and we see you have a family history of heart disease, and we see that you're precancerous, but we like you. You're a good guy. We're going to give you the insurance. We're going to give you that policy. They'd be out of business overnight. That's not what they do. The people who come out and talk to you, most of the time, don't even know your name. You are a number, if you get called upon at all. And they run it through their algorithm as to what are the actuarial likelihoods that Jim O'Shaughnessy, who happens not to have heart disease, happens not to have cancer, and happens not to have any of the things I listed, is a good bet. And they're betting not on Jim O'Shaughnessy, they're betting on the cohort in this room that all score the same. Very much the way we do things. So I'm going to show you some of the names that are the highest priced names, and I'm not going to tell you that one of those names is not going to go on to soar and do very, very well. What I will tell you is that the overwhelming likelihood is that it will not. Because they call economics the dismal science for a reason, right? It's dismal. I mean, valuations matter. I used to, in the late 90s, I wrote a piece called The Internet Contrarian, in which I said, 85% of these companies are going to be carried out feet first. They're going to dead. You know, this is the biggest bubble we've ever seen. Valuation matters. And so they paired me up with a guy who was a crazed growth aficionado. And it was kind of like point counterpoint. And his point ultimately was that at the time I was 39, his point was, you know, for a young guy, you're really a fuddy-duddy. You don't understand, valuation doesn't matter anymore. It's eyeballs, man. It's how many eyeballs are on a screen. And I said, honestly, the only value of a stock is what it's going to pay you as its shareholder. The rest is absolute stories and frivolous. So what we found was by combining the various factors you see here, we got a much, much better sense for what a true value was. In many instances, we'd find a stock that had a very low PE, looked attractive on a lot of the other fundamental factors, and yet when we ran it through our value composite, it ended up being one of the worst stocks that you could look at. So if I want to underline a lesson here, you want to look at more than one factor to determine whether a stock is a true value. I cannot tell you, since we've shifted to the value composite, how many value traps we have avoided, because it catches the name and precludes it from our consideration. Now, here's how the worst decile of the value composite. It returns less than T-bills between 1963 and 2012. And look at the names. Tesla, Amazon, JCPenney, Netflix, Starbucks. Hey, I use Netflix. I'm addicted to Starbucks. Tea, not coffee. I'm not so sure I want to drive a Tesla given the amount of fires that I've seen. Never been into a JCPenney, so I can't comment on that. And am a ludicrous power user of Amazon. Love these companies. Absolutely love them as companies. As stocks, my belief is that they are vastly, vastly overpriced. And it's interesting. I heard Cramer on CNBC Squawk Box on Wednesday. They were talking about Tesla. And he made a comment that really stuck with me and I wanted to share with you. And it was this. It doesn't matter what their valuations are. These are cult stocks that people are going to buy no matter what. I kind of thought to myself, that's crazy. That's insane. If you can see a stock is so incredibly overvalued, but nevertheless you're going to buy it just so you own it, that's no way to invest. And look at the return, 1.5. T-bills did twice, three times that over the same period. So if I can impart another bit of wisdom here, these are the names you want to avoid like the plague. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard because many of these names that you're going to see when you go through your own value composite on your software, once we get that figured out, you're going to love the companies. These are going to be companies that you're like, oh, but I shop there. I've never had a bad experience at Amazon. I maybe do want to drive that Tesla as long as I've got a fire extinguisher with me. And therein lay the rub. Very, very popular stocks, ipso facto, get to be expensive. Why? Because investors bid their price to unsustainable levels. Right? Very simple. I like to apply Occam's razor, which is the simplest solution is usually the best. Right? So I'll give you an example. In the 90s at O'Shaughnessy Capital Management, we had a screen that looked for very cheap stocks that nevertheless had good momentum. And we picked up very, very early on Dell Computer. And it made it through the screen the next time, and it was up 120%, but what's still cheap. Made it through the screen the next time, still cheap, was up another 140%. And it went from me arguing on CNBC with another guest saying, Dell, that's a commodity product. Why would anyone want to buy Dell? That's stupid. And it went to that to Michael Dell being on the cover of Fortune magazine. And, you know, the headline was something like, can anyone stop this man? And just as that cover showed up, we had to sell. We had to sell because the disciplined approach that we had followed found that Dell, while attractive in many other respects, was now very and deeply overvalued. There's a correlation, okay? So I don't ever want to be on the cover of a magazine because it means O'Shaughnessy, best money manager of the year. Okay, sell, goodbye. And you know, you might want to think that way in terms of when you see the CEO of a company on the cover of Forbes or Fortune. Not always. Forbes does some really interesting stories where they intentionally put somebody who's had a hard knock and they think is going to come back. So you have to pick and choose. But the fact is that we were forced to sell just as everyone else was buying. And that underlines the discipline part of our message. One of the most difficult things in the world to do is to stand by a discipline. I'll tell you, in 2008, I was like, I really didn't want to have to suffer that pain. But the only way you suffer the pain is to get to the gain. And so, as individual investors, it's going to be doubly hard on you. Mark my words. What I suggest you do is you write a contract with your husband or your wife, and you both sign it, and you pull it out when things are going really, really bad. And you kind of shame each other into staying with your investments. Because if you don't, you will sell. There's just no question. I had a client in Washington, D.C. Our clients tend to be advisors and institutions. The advisors deal with individual investors. And so right near, I published a piece called A Generational Buying Opportunity in March of 2009 for equities. And so he'd been a client for 12 years, and we went down to see him. And I went into his office, and he said, "Stop right there, O'Shaughnessy." I went, "What?" And he goes, "I know you're going to have all sorts of charts, all sorts of reasons why I should be committing money to the equity market right now as opposed to taking it out. I don't care. I don't care." And I said, "Well, you know, you're letting your emotions dictate your decisions, and I think 5 years from now you would desperately care." And he goes, "Yep, that's exactly what I'm doing. Goodbye." So this is a guy I'd known for 10 years who understood our story, understood our way of investing, and yet still, at the height of that insanity, said, "That's it. I'm done." Another thing that's interesting about the value composite, and this looks a little strange, but the black line is the return for the value composite. The other lines are how individual factors do vis-a-vis the value composite. So look at the green line. That's free cash flow to enterprise value. And I can guarantee you right up there at the top, lots of academic papers were being written about why free cash flow to enterprise value was the only thing you wanted to do. Note what happened afterwards. Basically, the minute people... And by the way, I stand accused of this crime too. When I said that price-to-sales ratio was the best of all the value factors, I was writing at it right about here. But what you see here is that in any given rolling 10-year period, the value composite outperforms any individual member of the value composite about 85% of the time. So that's a very high batting average in terms of using something consistently and well, paying less attention to the individual members of that composite. Well, we also wanted to take a look at, are there ways that we can avoid stocks? One of the things that, as classic value investors on the traditional bent, is that, hey, you know, we've got a company like Citicorp, and it's 2007, and it's got the highest yield in the S&P 500, and it scores in the bottom decile of the value composite. If we were only going to look at those two things, we'd say, let's buy Citicorp. But when you apply the financial strength overlay, what you found was that in terms of financial strength, Citicorp was in the weakest decile because they had taken on huge sums of debt in the prior 12 months. So this is an example of a strategy which helps us allow not to buy. In other words, we're looking for things that are deathly to a stock's health. And the one on this list actually that is the most deathly is external financing. What's external financing? External financing is when they start issuing all sorts of new stock, all sorts of new bonds. In other words, they are not financing their company using cash flow because they can't. So what they're doing is they're issuing stock, they're issuing bonds, they're issuing warrants, they're issuing everything they can. If you look at just external financing, you actually have a negative return between 1963 and 2012. That's why when anyone asks me about an IPO, I say no. Do not buy it, because it's the height of external financing. And sure, people love the thrill of watching them go up however much in a week or two, and you know that that's all because the investment bank has engineered that to happen, with the exception, of course, Priceline, where the engineers maybe didn't finalize their degrees in financial engineering. But you generally want to avoid those types of companies financial strength really helps us out of a lot of binds. So, for example, we did not buy Citicorp at that super high dividend yield, super low on the value composite, but its financial strength was very, very much lacking. Financial strength works okay on its own. I wouldn't advocate anyone, once your software is adapted to being able to make use of proxies of these composites, I wouldn't say, hey, go and buy the 10 stocks that score the highest on financial strength. I would rather tell you, use this as a check against the investing you're doing in terms of the value composite. Some of the names that have the best financial strength, not too many surprises here. GameStop, 3M, Gap, ExxonMobil. Gap is a great example of a stock we owned for many, many years. Now we're moving out of it because it's not qualifying as much. But you know, you don't think of necessarily Gap as being a financially strong company. But it, in fact, is. And is another example of, it's one of the few names, well, 3M and Exxon, obviously, we know those names. But the other thing that I stressed a little earlier, don't let the name get in front of you. Don't look at something and say, well, you know, I have no idea what this company does. You know, why should I be willing to put money in it? You should be willing to put money in it because the market has mispriced it. One of the biggest things that indexing and the growth of indexing has done is it's made life a lot easier for people like everyone in this room. The reason for that is because most market indexes are cap-weighted, right? So really, you're getting the returns of the top 25 names. Those are the ones where all the analysts look at everything, everybody's studying everything. And then there are thousands and thousands of names that aren't being looked at all. And what happens is they get better and better priced. Why? Because no one's looking at them. And when you look at them through the tools that we're providing here, you can come up with a great list of stocks as opposed to a great list of companies. We once went through, you know, Fortune magazine has the most admired companies. And when you actually see how they did about 150 basis points less than the index. Again, that's the name recognition. My son, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, is writing a book called Millennial Investors. And one of the things that he has done is he has done sector leaders and sector laggards. The sector laggards are the cheapest by the value composite. Sector leaders is simply the biggest stock by market cap in that particular sector. Well, you don't have to see this one coming from too far away. The sector laggards kills the sector leaders. So do not get hypnotized by a name. And definitely look at underlying characteristics. We think they are the way to define what a good investment is. So financial strength on the downside, well, there's JCPenney again. Kraft Foods, Ford Motor Company, John Deere. Look at the base rates. They're very, very horrible. Generally speaking, if we went back to value just for a second, look at the 7-year base rate for value. It's there. Can anyone take a hazard a guess when the worst performing decile managed to beat the market? What were the 7 years ending? 1999, when we had a huge bubble. So this is another piece of learning. If you're doing your homework and you notice that the value composite's worst decile over the last 5 years has beaten the market, watch out below. You're on your way to a bubble or a bear. Because ultimately, this stuff makes sense. Ultimately, people regain consciousness and say, do I really want to be paying 1,000 times earnings for AOL? I don't think so. And unfortunately, they all see the exit at exactly the same time. So back to financial strength. These are names, again, to be avoided. Here's just an example. When we look at the composite score, GameStop gets a 10, which means it's in the best decile for financial strength. Poor JCPenney, I don't mean to beat up on JCPenney, but it just has so many things wrong with it. It gets a 100, which means that's the worst. So in we look at 3,700 stocks. On that score, it would score 3,700. So probably you don't want to buy the story there. You want to look at the underlying information. This next one is very interesting because this was the first time as a team we started looking inside the balance sheet. And looking inside the balance sheet has proven extraordinarily useful. Primarily because, well, you know the old joke, right, about the company who wants to hire a new CFO. And everyone comes in and they sit them down in a chair and they say, we have one question, what's 4 plus 4? And they go, 8? Thank you. Bring the next one in. What's 4 plus 4? 8. Okay, thank you. We'll let you know. They bring the next person in. Very attractive woman sits down. They say, what's 4 plus 4? She goes, what number do you have in mind? That's what this is. What we want to do with earnings quality is to make sure that she isn't the CFO of that company. What we want to do is look at things like accruals, and they should be low, not high. We want to look at CapEx. We want to see them capitalizing their expenditures faster rather than slower. These are all the tricks of the trade that clever CFOs use to make earnings look better than they are. And when you have a very bad score on financial strength, it generally leads a quarter or two quarters later to really bad earnings. So it's kind of a forecaster of if you've got a rotten financial score strength, about the next earnings cycle or the one after that, there's going to be a big earnings surprise to the downside. So again, we're going to just use the same people to bully on here, our good friend Enron. So I had a friend who was a fund manager, and he was a big holder of Enron. And I was like, I Enron does not look good on a bunch of the various things we look at. And he said, listen, O'Shaughnessy, I know you're a quant, and I know, but you just have completely given away human insight. And I went, yeah, and that's why we're doing so well. And he said, because Bernard Baruch used to say, he was a legendary on of the early 20s in the 20th century. And they asked him, you know, Mr. Baruch, are there 10 rules that we should follow in determining how to buy or sell a stock? And he goes, look, I'll boil it down to 2. He goes, if the shoeshine boy is talking about stocks, get out of the market. And he goes, and number 2, never believe anything a president of a company tells you. So this pal of mine said, listen, I got invited to a super exclusive barbecue at Ken Lay's place. Everybody was there. Ken was there. The CFO was there, Skillering. All the top people were there. They looked me in the eye and said, this is nonsense. We are buying our stock. This is total nonsense. Take it to the bank. And so he went and bought a lot more Enron. Well, if we were just going to look at Enron, not through Ken Lay's lies, what would we have seen? That's what we would have seen. Enron was consistently in one of the first or second deciles based on earnings quality. Why? Well, because they were cooking the books. They were criminals. And yet, it shows up in the fine print. Again, the truth loves the fine print. And if you're looking at what they were doing, it caused them to score always in the worst two deciles as the stock went up, and ultimately, we all know what happened at the end. So earnings quality is a great thing to add as a layover. Again, the drivers here should be for a value portfolio, should be the value composite, and then shareholder yield, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And for a growth portfolio, same value, earnings quality, and financial strength composites, and then price momentum, which we'll also discuss in a minute. Very simple, very straightforward, but it keeps you out of the way, harm's way, with a lot of names that people really fell in love with, much to their chagrin. So for right now, these companies have really great earnings quality. Lowe's, Safeway, Pfizer, Home Depot, and very good base rates. On their own, remember, we wouldn't use this to select a security on its own, but we definitely would use it as an overlay. In terms of what's not so good, Qualcomm, GM, Government Motors, isn't that a shock? The government comes in, I think their earnings quality would be pretty poor. Don't really mean that, NSA, please strike that from the record. Costco and CarMax. And again, base rates not at all encouraging. So I think if we're going to take a takeaway from this is these are your building blocks, okay? How can you use them as building blocks to put together a type portfolio that is right for you? Well, one thing we wanted to chat about, we have a portfolio we call Enhanced Dividend. It uses all of these particular things in terms of determining that these are financially strong companies with good earnings quality, with excellent valuations. And then we buy the stocks that have either the highest shareholder yield, if you're looking for domestic stocks, or the highest dividend yield if you want a global dividend portfolio. And by the way, I would underline that. Right now, U.S. high dividend stocks are priced at a premium. If you open your portfolio search up to the globe, you can find them at deep discounts. So essentially what we do is then base that on dividend for global markets. You can see the difference here is rather extraordinary. The base rates are better. Your dividend is better. The dividend yield on this portfolio right now is a little under 5%. Compare that to a 10-year treasury. We actually, at our website, which is www.osam.com, have a piece written about how you can use this effectively as an income generator. And what happens is, when down markets, your yield goes up. So if you're only looking at dividend yield, this is a great way to invest for a rising dividend yield, something you're never going to get when you're in the bond market. And just to give you an example of how a stock gets bought or sold, if you look at these two names, a lot of people think of Merck as a great dividend company. But when we run it through the various screens, it turns out that this other pharmaceutical company, AstraZeneca, is a much better purchase. It's stronger financially, it's stronger in value, it's stronger in earnings quality. And the thing to keep in mind is it doesn't really matter where the company gets its mail, right? If it's in the UK or if it's in Germany, for the most part, we have become a global economy. And many of these international global companies are actually getting, in many cases, the majority of their revenues from outside their home country. The same is true for a lot of U.S. stocks. So we really have, it's not as scary to open up your portfolio to a bigger universe outside of just the United States. The good news is the U.S. has about a 33% share of the MSCI All ACWI index, so we're the least troubled by investing mostly in U.S. stocks. You go up to Canada, they account for 2%, and if their portfolio is all in Canadian stocks, that's kind of a tough thing to be. One of the simplest, here are the top 10 names, and the weighted dividend yield is 5.69, and my guess is that most of you have not heard, maybe other than BP, of virtually any name on that list. Again, don't sweat the names. Sweat the underlying factors that determine those names. Finally, this is a real simple strategy, and it emerged actually as one of the best that we looked at. I was talking earlier about really one of the strongest signals that we've found in all of our research is marry cheapness to momentum. Basically, this strategy says we're going to take the best decile by value, and then we're going to buy the 25 names that have the best price momentum. And there's different ways you can do it. For this illustration, we use 6 month. We have a momentum composite that uses 3, 9, and 12 month momentum, and then a standard deviation of return to lower the volatility of that momentum. But it works regardless. This particular strategy between 1963 and 2012 returned that. One of the very best performers that we were able to find. And it's because basically we're buying very cheap stocks just as the market is recognizing that, these are really cheap stocks. What's interesting is look at one of the names on here, Herbalife. Takes a lot of guts to buy that name. And yet, there it is. It's on the top 10 of the list. You probably don't know any other name on there. But if you do, kudos to you. You're an obscure person who knows quite a bit about the various names that make up the market. Finally, in closing, what I'd like to say is this is not unknowable. When you look at the various results that we see, basically a disciplined, unemotional approach can be the way to do better than you could ever, ever do, taking a haphazard hit and miss, so-and-so told me about this stock and it sounds good to me. Always look at the underlying. I mean, could imagine, would you go to a doctor who said, looked at you and goes, yeah, take that yellow pill. Well, why am I going to take the yellow pill? I got a good feeling about the yellow pill today. I got a good feeling about finding another doctor. You want to go to the doctor that's going to give you a physical. It's going to determine what your characteristics are. It's going to give and prescribe, if you need medicine, he's going to prescribe the right medicine for you. That's all we're doing here, is trying to prescribe the best medicine for your particular needs. With that, I will say thank you and open it up to questions. Yes, sir. They are. The question was, are the parameters equally weighted in the value composite? They are. We are looking at tilting, but we don't want to get too cute. And, you know, there's a spectrum on people who do these back tests. The very conservative side says you got to have out of sample. You've got to have, you know, you've got to be able to prove that it works every which way from Sunday. And then the group over here is, we can tilt, we can do all these things. To me, that's data mining. And I worry a lot about it. So unless I can find a kind of foolproof methodology where the data speaks for itself, where it works on an out-of-sample holdout period, then I'm going to say no. What would happen, you know, the intuition is you're going to be overweighting that free price to cash flow at enterprise value just that it's at its top. So we tend toward the conservative. Yes, sir. Ma'am.
Just a clarification. You were talking about financial strength, and you mentioned four companies, 3M, Gap, GameStop, and ExxonMobil as examples. But then, there you mentioned Gap, but you had recently maybe were going to remove that. But then you also had JCPenney on the underlying. So I wasn't, you had it on two different slides, both under financial strength. I was confused.
Well, the JCPenney slide was showing that it was not financial, if I'm correct, okay. Was showing that it was not financial. Huh? They've kicked me out already.
What was the
The question was about JCPenney and Gap.
List.
And my savior. It was the slide on financial strength. Worst financial strength. Nothing there. They have a time schedule to adhere to.
Okay. And then you just. Okay.
I shouldn't have made that crack about the NSA. They turned me down. Could you just after we'll okay. I'll discuss it with you.
Okay.
Yes. They've done very well, particularly on the value side. Our market leaders, the question was, how have our portfolios actually done? On the value side, our microcap is up 55% year to date and is one of the top performers this particular year as well as for the last 3 and 5 years. Our market leaders value, which is a large cap value portfolio, is in the upper percentile for the last 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 year period. Our small cap value, similar situation. So we've done very well. And it, from our point of view, and I would urge you to look at our website to see the actual numbers. The thing that we really get excited about is when we run a back test of a particular strategy and then we compare it to the real time for that strategy, and we have many strategies that have more than 10 years of real-time track record, and you find it's virtually identical to what you saw in the back test. So we've done well. All the way in the back. Is there any way we could get him a microphone? Hi.
How do you go about qualitative factors? Is it something that you look at all, or do you have only quantitative assessment of companies? A lot of companies, for example, appear in value screens like your screens or the magic formula, for example, in the for-profit education.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, they would all appear because you had, you know, the fear that for-profit education would be a scam, or at least that would be a change in regulations, which disrupts the business models of some of those value stocks.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and it's something that we are actually doing a longer-term research project on as we speak. There have been a slew of, obviously, new regulations that are going to affect companies. And so we'll probably be publishing something about that probably mid-2014.
Okay, Katie has a question over on the other side, Jim.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
Today, most stocks are selling at or close to their 52-week highs.
Mm-hmm.
How does a value investor find a cheap stock with that kind of an environment?
Yeah, great question. And I can answer it two ways. Just because they're at their 52-week high does not mean that they don't still score in the lowest quadrant of the value composite. In fact, a 1989 article in the Wall Street Journal said that when they went looking for stocks that had tripled in the ensuing year, they shared three characteristics. One was that they were cheap. Two was that they were at or near their 52-week high, and the third one was that momentum continued to go. So you can definitely, I tend to say, let's not look at price per se, let's look at value. So it would be obviously a very different question if every stock that was at a 52-week high also scored mediocre on the value composite. That would be cause for concern. But because it is a market of stocks and not a stock market, we find that we can always find and identify companies that are still cheap, nevertheless doing well.
Thank you.
Yes, Jim, we have Joe has a question at the back.
Okay.
Was there a question over here? Would you please explain base rates?
Good question. I'm sorry I didn't do a good enough job on that. We think that they are really the most important thing to look at. And what a base rate is in real time, rolling 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, etc., how often did your particular portfolio provide excess return over its benchmark? So, for example, if you have a 7 year base rate of 100%, in all rolling 7 year periods, you provided excess return over your benchmark. Conversely, if you have a rolling 3 year base rate of 90%, that means that 90% of the time you provided excess return over your benchmark, but 10% of the time you did not. We find them very valuable because it sets the investor's mind into thinking not of just one discrete period, but rather how all periods performed. Obviously, the higher the batting average or base rate, the higher the excess return associated with that base rate, the more confidence an investor can have that it will return to that particular thing, particularly if it finds itself in one of these spaces where it is underperforming. It's excellent information to give to an investor because you can say, look, if you're with us for 10 years, you're going to underperform at least one of those years. If it's a 90% base rate, if it's an 80, you're going to underperform at least two of those years. And then the other thing that we like to do is we like to do an analysis of what happens afterwards. So, for example, one of the reasons why I wrote the piece in March of 2009 was we went and looked at the 50 worst 10-year periods back to 1871. And the 10 years ending February of 2009 were the second worst. The first worths were May of 1920. But we weren't interested in the carnage, only what happens afterwards. And what we found was if you ignore the one-year number, all the numbers were positive. And on a rolling basis as well as, you know, everything else. So we find the concept of a batting average to be very educational. And also it removes the investor from why did you do so poorly or good this quarter, as opposed to, you know, where are you in that base rate cycle?
Jim, we have another question back here.
Yes.
Jim, you had talked about looking at the global. I'm more to your right. But you'd looked at the, mentioned looking at the global marketplace for dividend stocks. And
yes.
I was wondering if currency considerations enter into your valuation and maybe in general even external factors of, like Obamacare could affect insurance companies
sure.
and things like
That's
that.
That's a great question. What we found when we did the research was that if you were in more than five separate currencies, there was a natural hedge that got created. When you were much more likely to be a one against one currency, it probably made sense to hedge the currencies against one another. But, five plus currencies, kind of a natural hedge.
Got a question over here?
We got one up front. We've been not good to these folks. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Some AI stock screens select stocks under 25 million market cap. Mm-hmm. So today, do you think 25 million is still the point that you would suggest people not go below?
We were just talking about that earlier today, and I have a funny story for that. Now, this guy finds a stock in his Wall Street Journal, and it's up like 50 under $25 million. I had written in my book that they were a chimera because of the liquidity, and that certainly no one like me could buy them, but perhaps people who had $50 or $100,000 to invest could. And so the story goes that the guy sees this stock and he gets all hot on it because it's up 50%, calls his broker and he goes, buy me 1,000 shares of this. And the broker goes, I don't think we should do that. And he goes, buy it. So he buys it, looks in the newspaper the next day, or more likely online, and sees that the stock is up 100%. And he's like, I've hit pay dirt. I'm in. He calls the broker, put my entire IRA into it. And broker goes, I really don't want you to do that. And he goes, yeah, who was right the last two times? Do it. Broker goes, okay. Puts it all in, and next day he checks it. It's up 500%. And the broker, so he calls, he's, here's my windfall. I'm happy. Calls the broker, and he says, sell. And the broker says, to whom? So you got to be really careful about illiquid names. We, in our micro cap, we have a $25 million to $250 million, but we require liquidity. You can definitely, if you run it through these paces, it's a great place to find completely forgotten names, many of which have wallowed in obscurity forever. And so my answer would be, potentially you can, but it starts hitting those liquidity. The bid-ask spreads start to spread dramatically. And you're really talking about pink sheet names. I would advise caution. Yes, sir. Yes, there are three. O'Shaughnessy Enhanced Dividend, O'Shaughnessy All Cap Core, and O'Shaughnessy Small to Mid Cap Growth. Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier about that you were working with AII to develop some kind of data through our system.
Yes. Sure. Well, when we published the article, the question was that we are working with AAII, my research team, to develop versions of what we've discussed here today. Obviously, we have different data sets than AAII does. So one of my team members already had a conversation. They're working on it as we speak. And with any luck, we'll be able to deliver that to AAII. And you also, using your software, will be able to use versions of these proxies.
Katie, do you have a question?
We got a question over here.
Okay.
It appeared to me like you used historical data, but you're trying to predict the future. And today, most corporations and institutions use Monte Carlo simulation mm-hmm. or other methods in conjunction with what you've done to predict possible future outcomes. Mm-hmm. What role does simulation play or not play in what you're discussing?
Good question. The question was, you seem to be doing it on a more straightforward basis, and you're not using Monte Carlo simulations, et cetera. Couple of things. We like to look at the semi-standard deviation below zero, which is the how risky is this portfolio throughout time. We like to look at the number of drawdowns and the maximum decline. The Monte Carlo simulations, not to get too technical, but are all based on the assumption that markets are mean variant. Mandelbrot proved in the 1960s that markets are not mean variant. They are chaotic normal with very fat tails and very peaky middles. So I find with the Monte Carlos, because they've made that assumption, the data is not as good as it would be expected to be, with all sorts of outcomes that are highly unlikely considered, and a much less robust way of trying to get to kind of what the delta is. So it's our contention that because at the end of the day, human beings are the ones making pricing decisions in the marketplace. That's what makes valid the work looking at the tulip bulb craze, the land speculation craze in Florida, the automobile craze, the railroad craze. All of them had their antecedents in different and new technologies, but investor reaction to them was identical. Isaac Newton, one of the most brilliant men to live, lost a fortune in the South Sea Trading Company, and he said that he could calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of men. And it is our contention that as long as the madness of men and women price securities, the patterns that you see going through remain the same. I mean, if you look at 2007, for example, the simulations, I was at Bear Stearns at that time, and the simulations of value at risk, hey, everything was hunky-dory. And I was running around talking to anyone who would listen. This is insane. Real estate is insane. You can't have funds selling collateralized debt obligations with 40 times leverage. And everyone on the street had the same fund. It wasn't just Bear Stearns, it was everybody. Goldman, Lehman, Merrill, you name it. And so we prefer the less sophisticated, you know, look over long periods of time, how bad can things get, and how often does that happen? And we think that that's a very good proxy for moving forward.
Jim,
yes, sir.
One more question over here on your right.
And I guess we should probably make this, unless you don't care, I'm happy to tell your next event.
A question, sir, about...
There's been a fair amount of academic literature lately that's shown that signals or factors like this, once they get published in the academic literature, tend to perform not as well. Certainly a certain class of them that are that can be arbitraged. And accruals is a great example of it. You know, back in the 90s when Hand came out with that, you could make a lot of money with that. Now everybody knows about it. It's easily taken advantage of,
right.
So it's kind of disappeared. How does that factor into the things that you're looking at, and what's your take on all of that?
Good question. All I can provide is the evidence of the strategy I just outlined, Market Leaders Value. That has been in the public domain for 14 years. Hundreds of thousands of people have read What Works on Wall Street, and it continues to work. And it continues to work because of the human anomaly, I would say, rather than the mechanical anomaly. When I started out life, I was a total geek and had come up with a way to use implied volatility to ascertain which option to either sell short or to go long. And it was a mathematical formula based upon Black-Scholes pricing. And I did really well with it until I found an academic paper on it, and then it disappeared. Because that was a mechanical anomaly. It was not a human anomaly. I think, you know, the four horsemen of the investment apocalypse are fear, greed, hope, and ignorance. And only ignorance is not an emotion. Right? Fear, greed, and hope have wiped out more portfolio value than any single bear market. And human beings, unfortunately, are very predictable. We act in a haphazard, unpredictable way. When things are hot, we love them and we embrace them, but show just 3 months of underperformance and we're on to the next thing. And I think it is that reaction which demonstrates why over long periods of time you can continue to get success from these anomalies. Now, there will be those shortfalls, right? There was the flash crash of May of 2010 where all the quants went crazy at the same time. Our portfolio went down on that day, but we did something very different than them. We didn't sell. And sure enough, they all lost a fortune, and our stock prices bounced right back up. So I think that is where you need to look more at the interaction between human behavior and the mechanical side of an anomaly. Precisely right. There was actually a Swedish study that looked at identical twins and found that 50% of the way we choose to make investments is innate. It's in our DNA. And Those are, I love, basically I call what I do arbitraging human nature. And it's been good to me.
One more,
okay,
Jim?
One last question.
We have one over here, Jim.
Hi, sir. All this analysis over the last 30, 50 years is dependent upon the thought that the rules of the game don't change. And the question is, as we go forward with the government printing $4 trillion worth of money, mm-hmm. if we're in the quantitative easing business for another couple of years, mm-hmm. does that inherently change the whole dynamic or rules of the economy that the stock market operates within?
That's a good question. Well, one of the things that we did, there's some great data, the Dimson data that goes back to 1900, and it covers every emerging stock market. And we aggregate it just to see how a world investor could do. Keep in mind that Germany and Russia went to zero. Japan went to zero. And they were rebuilt and subsequently very popular markets. You know, we didn't call it quantitative easing in the 1970s, but we did exactly the same thing that we're doing now. We sold our debt to, at that time, the Japanese, and then we inflated our way out of it. And we get to do that because we're the world's reserve currency. Really unfair, particularly if you're Japanese or Chinese. But the fact is, we did it. And so I'm not trying to maintain that there's nothing new under the sun. I am trying to say that we've been down this road before, and it worked. And I don't know if it's going to work as well this time because of the interrelated nature of economies. But the fact is that as long as the United States remains the reserve currency, and make no mistake about that, you know, you read daily stories about how the Chinese or the Japanese or the Russians are going to try to become the world's reserve currency. And, you know, that leaves out the simple fact that the black market these days is almost as large as the official market. And the black market is conducted entirely in U.S. dollars. So I think that, yes, the QE, it will cause dislocations when it stops. There's no question about that. But as I mentioned, we did look at the 16 times since 1927 when the long 10-year bond went up by more than 100 basis points. And interestingly enough, 80% of those times, U.S. stock markets were positive. So that sort of tells us that even with rising rates, the U.S. markets remain a hedge against that rise. So I think that, there have been a lot of changes, but, you know, put yourself back to 1971, you want a big change. Nixon slams shut the gold window and completely ends any relation between the U.S. dollar and gold. Essentially, with one sweep of a pen, turning the United States dollar into a fiat currency. Prior to that, the U.S. dollar had been backed by gold or silver, mostly gold, and thus unleashed the great inflation. $1, I'm 53, so in 1960, $1 then is worth 15 cents today. So Keynes, the economist, had a wonderful quote, which is, "The most insidious way to destroy the society from within is to debase its currency." And the problem is, that's happening universally. It's not just us. With that, I will say thank you and enjoy your lunch.